thank you to the Foundation for this very welcome invitation to speak. It tells you something, although this will be against the drift of the rest of my talk, that when I was asked to speak about C.P. Snow's lecture, I assumed that the rubric was to speak not just about Snow, but about Snow versus Leavis. Indeed, I even prepared an alternative slide, which would have given you the face of the scientist next to the absolutely vitriolically angry face of the humanist. So I ask you to imagine that into its place. I am going to speak about anger and why what Snow had to say inspired so much anger at the time, and whether there's any use to be had of that anger now. It's commonly and rightly said in the field of legal ethics that we argue badly from extreme cases. The same is not as true of cultural history. At least I take it that the task this evening is to try to ensure that a bad, and on the humanities side, I fear a very bad argument, can yield something of intellectual and political use to us all. Two culture arguments. Is it? Can I? David, I wonder if I could borrow the... I had a suspicion about this one. Thank you. Is that going to be better? Okay, fine. All right. Two culture arguments are by their nature polemical. Matthew Arnold versus T.H. Huxley, C.P. Snow versus F.R. Leavis, Alan Sir Carl versus the editors at Social Text. More recently, long before any of them, the battle of the ancients and moderns and the old rivalries of Ars and Scientia. As expressions of divergent outlooks or priorities, the debates take what credibility they have from walking a thin line between plain statement and overstatement. The conventional locus is the lecture, the public speech, the polemical essay, in more recent years, the blog and the web posting, often with institutional encouragement to stage a conflict. Even set within a long genre of expectation, Snow versus Leavis stands out for the sheer animus injected from the humanities side. The hardest thing T.H. Huxley had to say about humanists is that they illegitimately arrogate for themselves the monopoly of culture, ignoring the vast and constantly increasing part which is played by natural knowledge. For Arnold, in reaction, the scientist gives us knowledge, yes, but only knowledge, not put for us into relation with our sense of conduct, our sense of beauty, and touched with emotion by being so put. It is the great power of humane letters to create that relation and thereby to make one live more, he said. Both Huxley and Arnold assumed that human beings are to an extent divided from birth in their aptitudes. They have a natural bent of mind. That assumption, along with their liberal generalism, dilutes the degree to which education can be deemed responsible for cultural distinction in the personal and collective senses. To turn from that strong but not intolerant articulation of cultural and natural differences in the 1880s to the aggravated antagonism of F.R. Leavis weighing in against C.P. Snow is to find the theater of character in our disciplines far more exaggerated. For Snow, the scientific culture is distinctively intensive, rigorous, constantly in action, exacting in its requirements for objectivity and reasoned argument. It is optimistic about progress, however pessimistic the scientist as individual may be. Snow's aim is to counter a bias against science institutionalized, he thought, with the help of politically too influential literary men. Complacent in their no longer earned cultural authority, they tended to pessimism and conservatism, in certain prominent cases, close to his period, to fascism. Snow's long goal, as we've heard, was to give future governments access to new technologies in the fight against world poverty. For F.R. Leavis, in fierce reaction, Snow's view of the modern world was deadening, vulgar, and dangerously self-aggrandizing. If we want an understanding of what it would mean for individual lives to be filled with satisfaction and significance in anything beyond the basic material sense of satisfaction, he argued, we must turn to the great novelists and poets to enliven our individual sensibilities. The easy explanation for the hardening and sharpening of two cultures' conflicts between the end of the 19th century and the start of the 1960s would be the growing institutional power of science. But the easy explanation's inadequate. It's far from obvious that the enhanced institutional standing of the sciences should produce greater animus against the humanities, benign condescension perhaps, but why not mutual respect? The fact that Snow's original lecture attracted so much attention in its time and twinned with Leavis's response has continued to occupy attention, including tonight, has, I suspect darkly, something to do with the theatrical allure of so much vitriol expended by one Cambridge don against another. This is what people like to think about Cambridge, and it shows at least that the place really cares about the life of the mind. There's also the Swiftian lure of suspicion that something truthful as well as something distortive may be being said when politeness goes to the winds, in iri veritas. But quite so much anger from the humanist, Snow is said to be an intellectual nullity, as undistinguished as it is possible to be, a blankness, not a mind, and so on, leads one to wonder what degree of truth can survive the performance, and what, if any, value it has beyond being diagnostic of something psychologically awry. Leavis owed quite a lot to Arnold's sense of culture as self-perfection and the pursuit of the best that has been thought and said, but he owed, I think, at least as much on this occasion to Arnold's definition of criticism as an exercise in freedom. Culture, the intellectual culture fostered by the university and the wider public culture, seemed to him in such imminent danger from Philistines of Snow's ilk that he was prepared to resort to far nastier freedoms than Arnold ever stooped to, and Arnold wasn't averse to stooping. Leavis's contributions to the debate are galvanized by visceral loathing of the kind of public intellectualism, exhibited by Snow, who set up as a poster boy for the publicity-created culture of metropolitan London, lazily journalistic, complacent in its establishment credentials, in and out of the BBC and all over the New Statesman and the Sunday papers. As to content, the grounds of Leavis's disagreement were fundamental. The question that should concern the university and society more generally is not how are we to improve the general social condition, but what ultimately do we live by? It followed that, and I'll come back to this point because it seems to me at the core of what the two cultures has to say of relevance to us now, Leavis admits no real value in quantitative reasoning. On this matter, he appeals to D.H. Lawrence. It is only the social differences that are based on accidental material conditions. We are all abstractly and mathematically equal, if you like. Every man has hunger and thirst. We are all the same in point of number. But spiritually, there is pure difference, and neither equality nor inequality counts. Not least, Leavis upholds a vision of the university as something quite unlike Snow's place of research, assisting the advancement of global well-being. For Leavis, the university is or should be a center of consciousness for the community, a third realm neither professional, as a laboratory's professional, nor merely private and personal, though quite what the force of this metaphor can be, he never entirely clarifies. Now, it's a standard observation on this most famous and fractious of two culture encounters that it tells us very little about the kinds of work the participants' university colleagues were doing at the time, a great deal about the wider social, cultural, institutional, and political factors that had a bearing on the argument. Successive historical readings have pointed to the influence on both men of early 1960s debates over social class, culture, meritocracy, university expansionism, democracy, and the relation of technological progress to political progress. Recent commentators have especially stressed Snow's screening of the strength and political importance of the contemporary drive for technocratic modernization behind a largely fictitious argument about scientism. As important to Leavis, though the influence emerges only belatedly in subsequent writings after his own lecture, was the appearance 4 years after Snow's lecture of the Robbins Report with its recommendations for expansion of the higher education system to meet the needs of the economy. It seemed to Leavis grimly symptomatic of the state of higher education and politics alike that Robbins so unhesitatingly accepted Snow's account of the two cultures. Leavis's self-appointed task was to dislodge the obviousness of the diagnosis, as Robbins put it in his report, to expose behind the complacent diagnostic clichés a failure to grapple with the rootedness of intelligence in experience, and with it the need of a creative response to the new challenges of time. Much of the best critical literature on the two cultures after Snow and Leavis has put pressure on the number two, either working to flesh out a more serviceable model of three cultures inclusive of the social sciences, or stressing an underlying cultural unity to it all. Snow was at least alert to the objection on this score. Not far into the lecture, he confesses his unease about whether down-to-earth non-scientific acquaintances were right to warn him that he was oversimplifying. He was searching, he says, for something a little more than a dashing metaphor, a good deal less than a cultural map. I was more enamored of that clarification the first time I read it than I am now. Metaphor and map don't reside on a scale with one another. A metaphor isn't just a very small map, though perhaps a map might be a serviceable metaphor for metaphors of a particular kind. I take it that what Snow grasps at by more than a metaphor is an assertion that his description can claim some degree of reality or realism, and it's that I want to really press at tonight. What does he think he's getting at? The attraction of the word culture, as he elaborated it, was that it kept that sense of experiential reality in play. Clearly, the word could be taken in two senses, the personal sense of intellectual development of the mind and the anthropologist sense, and it's this second sense that is doing the critical work. Taking a more critical stance on Snow's term, it's clear that the argument by way of cultural differentiation is a quasi-anthropological argument rather than a description that would pass muster with the Department of Anthropology. Claiming a relation to anthropological observation, Snow's description isn't empirically grounded beyond his own broad brush observations and a bit of circulating anecdote. I'm in effect restating a little bit more neutrally what was for Leavis a matter of strenuous objection. There is no evidence. Certainly, an anthropological come rhetorical sketch leaves quite a lot of opacity about how the two senses of culture, personal development and collective behavior, are related, other than through the magic performed by the word culture. But Leavis's quick dismissal of the gloss that Snow offers, culture, he says, means that without thinking, scientists respond alike, doesn't help us get a grasp on what is helpful about the word and the gloss. However imperfectly worded, the claim under scrutiny here is that educational specialization has an effect on the psychological development of individuals, evidenced in their speech and actions, and on the group behavior of its recipients as they go about their professional and, to some degree, their public life. It's evidenced in common habits, common assumptions, a common way of life. This is, as it might be expected, particularly tricky terrain for the social sciences. Tony Betcher and Paul Trowler carve, I think, a fairly representative, careful middle path today through the difficulties in their book Academic Tribes and Territories. When they observe, the constructivist will see training in the academic disciplines as induction into a particular way of being, a personal and professional identity, a set of values, taken for granted knowledge and recurrent practices. The constructivist will, by nature of being a constructivist, err in ascribing too much to the training. So they're accordingly cautious. Some room should be allowed for the creative power of individuals. On the other hand, they say that power shouldn't be overstressed. As they see it, initiation into academic communities today is an efficient process, particularly at postgraduate level. There are, in short, social facts, as Durkheim put it. The effects of education, like other social facts, aren't rigid and unchanging, but they are observedly constraining. Insofar as educational patterns of specialization shape elements of our language, the ways in which we identify objects worthy of study, and the ways in which we deal with them, they have sociological force. My partner put it to me earlier today when we were talking over materialism that one of the things that makes academics so extraordinarily vested in these arguments is that they have, after all, dedicated their entire lives to one bit of it. So, observing how a humanities professor, a social scientist, and a scientist speak and act at a cross-disciplinary seminar may tell you very little about inner psychological states of the individuals, but it will certainly tell you a great deal about respective conventions of intellectual behavior and something about respective values and a lot about strategic interests at the particular time. I'll give you the benefit of my many hours on research grant allocation committees at Oxford and a little bit in Norway by telling you that I think humanities scholars tend to behave as if the world was solely a construction of language and rhetoric and there were no such thing as institutions, let alone data. Social scientists tend to see only the institutions in their own interpretive models. As for the physicists and certain kinds of medic, the more expensive the machine, the more important it must be. And please don't ask whether the university already has one. The difficult question for all of us, especially as we try to construct meaningful conversation across the divisions of the university, is how much such pattern divergences tell you about core values. I'm suggesting that characterological differences between disciplines require particular contexts to bring them out in force. It makes sense that the characterology of the so-called representative humanist, social scientist, physical scientist, or medic comes into sharp relief around the table of the Grant Allocation Committee or the University Financial Planning Meeting. and that it may look relatively subdued in a public conversation between the British Academy and the Royal Society, where it's in all our interests to learn amicably from one another. To put the point at its most general, conditions of competition often reduce the disciplines to their most extreme typologies. Conditions of cooperation make for less predictable behavior, more interesting behavior. This is why the term quasi-anthropological seems to me a helpful description of the two cultures debate. As a normative description of the work of disciplines, it just doesn't stand up. We're talking about aggregative effects of educational experience and the research practices across such a wide range of scales, different individual experiences of education, different kinds of institution, different relations to national policy making, different civic contexts, different kinds of object, methods of study, even at the level of the department. To describe those communities well anthropologically would require a lot of observational data. And the more data one brought in, the less sharply defined a figure the disciplines would cut. Take a look at Jerome Kagan's The Three Cultures. So the most dispiriting aspect of the two cultures argument as Snow and Leavis between them bequeaths it to us is the extent to which it tells us that there may remain a public appetite for understanding intellectual endeavor as a field of combat, and thus for seeing representatives of different disciplines in public conflict with one another. The most enlightening thing about it now seems to me the extent to which it shows us the grounds of opposition shifted indeed. Let me make three suggestions in closing. First, and there's some overlap here with the minister and indeed with Venki. First, if one were rescripting the two cultures to fit today's academic and political circumstances, there would have to be less talk of disciplines, I think, and much more about methods. At the core of our disagreements still, when they arise under conditions of competition or duress, is the difference not in value but in explanatory scope and thus meaning attached to quantitative and qualitative reasoning, to give you just one obvious example. I'm on Leavis's terrain in making this observation, but I can't go along with him, of course, in his apparent refusal to grant that a quantitative approach to human welfare has any real truth to offer us. Almost all our disciplines practice both modes of reasoning, but I'll hazard an observation that there's not yet anything like enough systematic encouragement to incorporate the two methods into a cogent piece of thinking alive to the limitations of rhetoric and the limitations of numbers and the value of both. Economic historians and medical humanities scholars may be showing us the way, insofar as they've had to learn that numbers are susceptible to rhetorical distortion. They require context, a sense of relevant scales, acknowledgement of source, and the strengths of weaknesses of source and weaknesses. I think we already knew that rhetoric is abusable. Second, and it should perhaps pain me more to say this than it does, Leavis has claimed that literature and the critical study of literature supremely have authority to speak about the ultimate ends of life. Seems to me far less likely to get a hearing now than it did in the years of Scrutiny, his magazine. And it's worth remembering how charismatically maverick a figure he was, even in the pre-professional context of Downing College, 1963. Thinking about one's ultimate ends can be important, even essential at critical points in one's life. That's partly what we mean by calling them critical points. But it's palpably not the only purpose, and often not the most germane one, of the university in any of its departments. Education has near goals as well as end goals, some of them appropriately modest. Improving knowledge and understanding of particular objects, problems, methods, so does research. It is much less clear now than it was in Leavis's day, and it wasn't clear then, that literature is the place to which culture turns first in search of truths about life. Literature itself has changed. It's far more plural in its attentions to different kinds and styles of lives and language. But the general culture has also substantially shifted its attention from the written word to the image, which is why so many departments of literature, even when they've stepped back from the term cultural studies, have embraced comparative work between textual and visual media. Take away the exclusive claim for the literary and replace it with a claim for critical attention to the cultures in which all human experience takes shape and acquires meaning, and you have a form of advocacy for the humanities that might attract more confidence. This must be especially so in a context where digital media and AI are rapidly changing the world we inhabit and the forms of work it will admit. Science alone, I'm agreeing here, will not explain or read the primary forces of human identity and the ties that bind and sometimes break us. Neither can the humanities alone. But without those readings, the sciences and social sciences will really be at a loss to effect the changes we can all deem desirable, and recognize the limits of what we can change. Finally, and very briefly, there is matter of political moment today in the disagreement between Snow and Leavis over how far the general tendency of human civilization is towards progress. Snow's claim that we don't have to be stupidly naive or forgetful about some of the achievements of the applied sciences in the 20th century in order to recognize that they put it within the power of human beings to do simple and manifest good. Sorry, this was Snow's claim. We don't have to be naive about them in order to recognize that they put it within the power of human beings to do simple and manifest good on a very large scale. Leavis' counterclaim was, in effect, that good is never simple, and the welfare fixes of technology and medicine will not suffice for happiness, or, more important to him than happiness, a public realm in which the mind can respond adequately, creatively, to the challenges of living a human life. Our domestic politics of late has given us ample cause to reflect that though our language has evolved, this isn't a difference in perspective that we can reason away. It is imperatively a difference we have to learn to live with and work with. Thank you. Thank you.